Are you ready for a close encounter of the tinfoil kind and want to do some collaborative writing with some of the most intelligent people on planet Earth? Then go to our board home at AboveTopSecret.com and find TinWiki.org in the Conspiracy Theory Discussion Forum area. TinWiki is an online encyclopedia where members can create new pages and where every page can be edited by anyone reading the page and wanting to improve it. The TinWiki Encyclopedia is for a specific type of topics only, such as conspiracy theories, UFOs, ghosts, paranormal phenomena, mythological creatures, lost civilizations, and life on other planets, just to name a few. So join thousands of other ATS members in creating an encyclopedia of AboveTopSecret.com articles that will be viewed by millions of members and guests from around the world. And if you happen to see William Wonsack or Optimus, tell them Dave Rabbit sent you.
Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to another fun-filled edition of the Above Politics Show. I'm Martin Bain.
And I'm Justin Case.
And guess what, Justin? Today we have an exceptional show for everybody. We start with an ATS member interview, then we move on to some commentary and the results of the recent trivia challenge.
Dave Rabbit will be sharing some special thoughts with us at the end of the show, too.
And we our mystery guest today is John White, who's on the phone with us. And he's been a contributor to Above Top Secret since February 2006. And he's a regular in the U.S. Politics Forum, where he appears, from my viewing, to lean more to the left of U.S. politics.
Say, Martin, do me a favor. You're still learning about Republicans and Democrats. Just before we get things going with Don here, what's the European version of an American Democrat?
That's a very good question. Let's just base it on the UK initially, because that's theoretically what I should know a lot about. A Democrat would sit similarly to the Labour Party, which is a socialist, left-leaning organisation, although clearly in the UK we have three political major parties. We have the Conservatives, who are on the right, who probably equate more to the Republicans. Then we have the Liberal Party, who are sort of seen as the middle ground. And then we have the Labour Party, who's seen as a socialist. So in many respects, the Democrats may well sit somewhere between the Liberals and the Labour Party. And then theoretically, as you go across the rest of Europe, the Democrats would clearly be seen as being much more left-leaning rather than right-leaning, where that would be the Republicans.
All right, then. With that explanation in hand, let's take him off hold and introduce Don White. Hello, Don. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Justin. Hi. Martin?
Well, hi to you. I'm glad to have another ATS member on the air, so why don't you take a moment and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I was born in Kentucky a long time ago. I lived there all my life. I went in the Air Force in 1952, finished college in 1965. I've worked for insurance companies. I've worked in the legal system, and I've worked for private enterprise at the last of my working career, and in 2003, I retired to Jacksonville, Florida.
Well, that's pretty cool. You know, you have something in common with Dave Rabbit in that I believe, from your dossier that we have here, your military service was conducted in the Air Force.
Yes, it was. I don't want to minimize the value of the Marines or of the infantry, but I wanted to serve my country, but my idea of going to war is to sleep on clean sheets at night. And so I joined the Air Force, and true enough, even though I was in Korea, we did have clean sheets.
And what were your duties in Korea?
I was a radio and radar repair man, and I worked on the old B-26s, and these were used by the time I got to them. They had been mothballed for a while. They were used for weather reconnaissance, so I was in a weather reconnaissance squadron.
I see. So, now, I have to ask, just because I know somebody out there in ATS is going to make the connection, because you were involved in radio and you were in a war zone, did you ever happen to do a little underground radio?
No.
Okay, no, sure.
I think I'm sure, yes, I've never done that.
Okay, then I just had to make sure, because, you know, Dave Rabbit's really famous for that sort of thing. And
I know you. Yes.
I want to protect you, because I don't think you would take kindly to the competition. Now that we've assured that you are definitely safe, tell us about what was life like as a B-26 fixer.
Well, it was great. It was great, because we felt like we were doing a job that was important. We worked, we didn't have regular schedule. We worked until the job was done. Sometimes that meant working around the clock. It was, like I say, I had a small group of guys. We were doing all of us working for the same mission. And so it's a great feeling that you get when you have a small group doing the same thing together.
Well, that's pretty cool. Did you at any point in time in your travels make it to or through Europe?
No, I regret that. But I never have been outside. I've been to Japan, Korea, Newfoundland, and the U.S. of A.
Okay, where in Japan?
Well, I came through Japan. Everybody goes to Tachikawa, which is outside of Tokyo, and then on R&R's, rest and recuperation, I went once to Nagoya, and I went once to Mount Fuji.
And how's the view from Mount Fuji?
I got to tell the truth. I stayed in a hotel where you could see it through a picture window, but as far as going to the top, I didn't. Although in Japan, it's like Mecca to Japanese. Every Japanese person wants to climb Mount Fuji during his lifetime.
Well, that sounds pretty cool. So tell us, how did you come to be a member of AboveTopSecret.com?
I was using Google, and I was looking for an interesting website to blog on. And I found a bunch of them, and I looked at several, and finally I realized that I was more at home on ATS.
Ken, what makes it homey to you, other than that new carpet smell?
Well, I like a lot of things about it. I like the fact that there are so many contributors. I think we're looking forward in the next few days to the 4 millionth posting, and that's a lot of posting. I also like the fact that the range of views are staggering, from left to right and up and down. Although I'm not a UFO fan, I don't mind talking to people about UFOs. I don't want to digress, but I did have a sight experience with UFOs while I was in the Air Force.
Oh, now you're going to have to tell us about that.
I was stationed at Savannah, Georgia. And I volunteered to be transferred to Limestone, Maine, because I was the only single guy in the unit. Well, the orders came down, and they sent me to McGee Tyson at Knoxville, Tennessee. And I got there, and I found out I was in the wrong unit. The people had made a mistake in my specialty code that I was in, and they had sent me to a unit that was a UFO hunter, 15th AISS, which stands for Air Intelligence Service Squadron. So
evidently not very intelligent if they picked up the wrong guy.
Well, it was the number, you know, like my number was 30151A, and they wanted somebody like 307928. But anyway, obviously, as soon as I got there, they knew I was the wrong person. But in the Air Force, they don't let you lay around. So while I was waiting for fresh orders, I was sent on an assignment to North Carolina with another person, and we interviewed an elderly couple in North Carolina who had called the local law enforcement about seeing strange lights. And so we went to a very, we had a detailed question and answer that we were supposed to get. We did that. We stopped at some neighbors and asked them about the reputation of the people, and we did that. And so it took us about 6 hours to interview all the people that we needed to interview, and we did all of those things that they asked us for. And then we took some pictures of the area that the people pointed at, and then we came back and we wrote up our report, and we sent it in to Operation Blue Book.
Oh, wow. What year did this happen?
This was in 1954.
Okay, well, that predates Martin and I by a little bit, so that's it. Well, that's interesting to know. What technology did you use in your investigation?
Actually, we didn't use any technology, unless, you know, the camera, just a regular camera. I guess it was a 30... It wasn't my camera. It was a military camera. I assume it was 35mm. I was just going along for the ride, and the other person did the brain work, and I sit there and acting like I knew what I was doing.
Well, I think that's pretty cool. I mean, even if you get to be just a UFO hunter for a day, it's still something that you can talk about, and I bet you it must be worth a few drinks in some bar somewhere.
You're right. The only problem I have is while I've been known to embellish a story, I really never did get into, you know, I never was a second or third encounter type person. This is my only experience is the first encounter.
Well, that's still good enough for me, because I've never seen a UFO, and I probably wouldn't say anything if I did. So
it might be dangerous.
Yeah, that's true. The way things are going today. So now, speaking of dangerous, this may be the de rigueur question anymore, but where were you on September 11th, and what was your impression of that event?
Well, I have to tell you the truth again. I was at home. It was my day off.
Do we have a filter for this, Martin? Are we equipped for
I think we probably are. I'd like to think we can probably get away with the truth occasionally.
Hey, I found it. There we go. It's on now.
Okay. I was at home on my day off. The secretary at the office called me after the first crash had occurred. They keep the TV on at the office. You can see how hard they work. And so I turned the TV on, and I think I was there in time to see the second plane crash, although I must tell you, it's been reshown so many times that I can't not really tell you the truth whether I saw it originally when it happened or whether I saw it repeated as I saw it, you know, like 100 times that day. And so that was my – I was at home when the – the 9/11 event occurred.
And did you see? I mean, I know it's a very obvious question, but you know, the whole world changed and America changed. But from a sort of political viewpoint, did you see or notice a change in attitudes between, you know, how the people responded to the government and maybe how the government responded to the people?
Yeah, I like you said before, I'm a socialist left type person, and it was my impression that from the very beginning, I've accused the present incumbent of co-opting the 9/11 event for his political advantage. I like to remind people that the stock market had already tanked by September. He'd been in office not 9 months, and the stock market had tanked, and the surplus that we had was given away, and so he was already being talked about as losing his control of Congress in 2002. So when the 9/11 event occurred, of course, that obviously gave him the opportunity that he needed to become the hero. And of course, Americans like that, you know, we like that. We don't take kindly to somebody slapping us in the face. So we fell right in with our, I guess you'd say, our culture. And he was there quick to take advantage of it, and he's never given up. He's like a pit bull.
And that's a good point. But one of the things I suppose I see outside of North America is that George Bush isn't seen as the sharpest knife in the block. So who do you think was behind the scenes that sort of orchestrated this one? Because it would imply that there were some very sharp minds that saw an opportunity and thought, we can do something with it. So I'm just wondering whether there are some people that you think who were, you know, behind the scenes with George Bush who basically guided him and advised him to go down this route.
I feel like it's probably Richard Pearl, Wolfowitz, I forgot his first name right now, Wolfowitz, obviously Rumsfeld, who never wavered from his approach to life, and then, of course, VP Cheney, Vice President Cheney, who I think was probably the intellectual genius behind the American response to the 9/11 event. You may have detected, I personally never refer to it as, I try to always refer to it as the 9/11 event, because I want to distinguish it from what the general public thinks about what occurred on September the 11th. So I call it always the 9/11 event, and I try to put it in the same text or context as the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, a criminal offense, not an act of war.
That's a very useful and differentiator there. That's a big word to say. And I suppose one of the things that I see is, what impact do you see that the 9/11 event has had on the presidential elections today? Can you actually trace back and say the elections are shaped this way because of the 9/11 event?
Well, I think we definitely can say the 2002 election was supported the people that supported the president. I think the 2004 election, again, you see, it was very close, really. If the Democrats had won the state of Ohio, they would have won the electoral vote, although they would have lost by 3 million votes in the popular vote. But so again, you see, it was very close. Now, of course, he can't run again, so it's irrelevant. But his successor, his apparent successor, will be John McCain. And I think McCain has already said that he intends to use the prosecution of the Iraq War as his campaign, a central theme of his campaign, which, of course, since I oppose that, I'm hopeful that we can beat him with the Democratic nominee.
And let's put you on the spot nice and clearly then. Clearly, you're a Democrat. There are two candidates who are currently going for the top job. Which one do you vote for?
I have to tell you, this truth meter is going to have to keep on working. I started out being a strong Hillary Clinton person because I thought it was time for a woman to be president. But I never had seen Barack Obama. And so Obama obviously is very attractive to people when you see him firsthand, because he did so well in Iowa, the very first caucus. He's done well in so many other places. I think he won 11 straight. But then I was pleased most of all by the speech he made after he had to respond to Reverend Wright, who had made a lot of accusatory statements, and I think his speech was presidential. I call it a presidential caliber speech. So at that point in time, I say to myself, I believe that Barack Obama is the man I want to vote for.
And there's another question, says, who do you think is the best candidate, the best Democratic candidate? And then there's a second question, who is the best candidate to beat Senator McCain? And are they the same person?
I'll pick the last part first. Yes, they're the same person. There's no doubt that we had several good Democrats. I would have personally liked John Edwards because he leans further left than anyone else that was running. I would have liked Bill Richardson. He was the governor of New Mexico who was a very nice person during the Clinton years. I've already said I like Hillary Clinton. I didn't know Barack Obama, but now I do know him, and I still like Hillary Clinton, but I like Obama better.
Now, on abovepolitics.com, you started a thread in which you compared Obama's shock and awe to St. Paul and Abraham Lincoln, and I can see here that discussion is still going on. Do you really think that comparison is fair?
Well, no, but in politics, anything's fair. Anyway, the reason I said St. Paul, I was thinking of Barack Obama when St. Paul made the speech in Athens, at the Acropolis, I think it is, when he argued with the Athenians over whether or not Jesus was resurrected. The argument was about the resurrection, and so definitely I think Obama resurrected himself. And then in regard to Abraham Lincoln, of course, Abraham Lincoln's speech, I was thinking about the one he made at the Cooper Union up in New York City the year before he ran, which everyone is described as the a nation divided cannot stand, or a house divided cannot stand, the house divided speech, in which he first told the world that he was going to stand for a single union. And the only way it could be a single union would be a free union and not a slave union.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Now, when I go back and I look at the YouTube clips of Obama's big three speeches recently, obviously the one on race stands out the most. But let me ask you this question directly. Are you prepared for the possibility that Senator Obama can win his party's nomination but lose to John McCain in a general election?
No, I don't want to hear that, but you have to be realistic. The truth is American politics are sharply divided. I think that's proof enough in the 2000 election and in the 2004 election. They're very sharply divided, and so that means about 49% are going to be for Democrats and 49% for Republicans, and so a very small number of people will decide how the election turns, and of course there may or may not be some accusations about racism brought up, but I think myself, the turnout that Obama's been getting of young, educated white voters indicates that it may be past the time for race.
But interestingly, Don, there's a huge difference between voting for the Democratic candidate and the caucuses and the primaries there, which theoretically are going to get more Democrats voting for those, in that when people are actually sitting there in the polling booth with the general election deciding, who am I actually going to vote for? And I'm just curious to whether you think that America is ready to take that huge step from voting for the typical white male to voting for a black male, or there's the intermediate step, almost, you could say, which is voting for a white female.
That's what makes a liberal, Martin. Liberals look at the face of reality, and we are willing to defy it, and we're willing to tell ourselves, yes, we can do that. That's what a liberal is, a person who knows the history of his country for 220 years, and he likes what he sees, and he's still willing to take that good chance. So, yes, I'm ready.
But do you think the rest of the American people are ready to do that?
Well, I don't know, but this is the first time. I don't really know. But to give you an answer, I would say yes. And I base that on the turnout, the huge turnout that the Democrats have been receiving in these primaries and caucuses ever since the first one. They've gotten so much more turnout than the other side has. And I'm telling you that this shows an interest level, a level of interest, which is unusual, unheard of before in Democratic politics. So I'm saying yes, I think that the American public, a large part of it, is willing to let race be in the past. And they want to look forward to a better world. And I think also, of course, we're going to have bad economics is going to drive people to the Democratic fold. And we're going to have the war going on. I hope not, but it probably will be. We're going to have the war going on, which will drive a lot of people, because it's going on badly. It'll drive people to the Democrat side.
Well, Don, I'm sitting here looking at another thread you started. Mr. Bush, am I better off today than I was in 2001? Now, knowing that when we go to the general election polls, we're going to vote with our wallets, it's obvious to anybody that we are worse off now than we were in 2001. So would you, in the context of that, say that John McCain has any chance at all of beating a Democrat?
No. I would think that rationally, looking at the thing, the way you just pointed out, it's true, everyone knows it, and it's just, it would be, no matter who was in office today, the opposite party would win in November.
Well, I think that's true. Ultimately, you guys could run a ham sandwich and John McCain is still going to lose.
That should be true. As we like to say in Kentucky, because I'm what we call in Kentucky a yellow dog Democrat, which means I would vote for a yellow dog in preference to a Republican.
Okay, now what's the difference between a yellow dog Democrat and a blue dog Democrat?
If you're a blue dog, you're from Georgia. Yellow
okay.
dogs are from Kentucky.
So is it cold there? Is that why they're blue? What's the deal with that?
No, I guess they got blue tick hounds down south and up in the Middle West or wherever else. I'll call it Middle West. They call it the South still in Kentucky. But up in the south of Kentucky, it's Old Yeller, Old Dog Yeller.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that one, yeah. I can appreciate that. Now, with that in mind, I'm also looking at another thread which you started in the U.S. politics section here regarding earmarks. Now, are you going to be willing to take your guys to task if in 2009 they start loading up the legislation with porky earmarks?
Yes. Beg your pardon. I happen to be one of those. I favor earmarks, and I understand earmarks. I do want them to be done. I want them to be transparent, and I want them to be done fairly. But you got to take this into mind. This is a struggle between the legislative branch and the executive branch. The executive branch, of course, proposes the budget, et cetera, and then they're the ones that carry it out. Well, the legislature, you see, even if you're a Republican and I'm a Democrat, I'm going to let you do your remarks because you're going to let me do my remarks when you're in the party, in majority. So the people, you know, we still have collegiality, even though we don't talk nice about each other. We still know there's some things we got to do together. And I'm in favor of this because it's the only way that that people in Congress have of doing things for their constituents, and that's important. You know, we don't have just one person elected in our country. We've got 536. We've got one president and 535 congresspersons, and they all got to stand in front of their constituents. They've got to produce. If they don't produce, they don't win. If you give it to the executive branch, we would have all Democrats or all Republicans if they had their way of doing it, because they would shut off the districts that, you know, weren't on their side. So the earmark is the legislative branches a way to fight back against the executive. I think they should be open, and I don't like them when they, you know, write it up in such a way that only the nephew of the congressperson can get the job. But that can be corrected very easily.
Well, now, what's going to happen when the Democrats control the House and the Senate and the White House? Aren't they going to do just what you said?
No, because in Congress, every congressman realizes that the presidents come, the presidents go. And you can look at John Murtha, for example, of PA, who gets the credit for being the largest earmarker on the Democrat side. Now, he's been there, 22 years, 24 years? How many presidents has he served through? Reagan, first Bush, Clinton, second Bush, third president. These guys have collegiality with their Republican counterparts who've been there the same length of time. So these guys don't care about who's in the White House. They do, you know, they'll take advantage of it, but they don't really care.
I think they're going to care a lot. I strongly suspect that when the Democrats have veto-resistant majorities and when they have their president in the White House, whoever he or she might happen to be, I think they're going to stick it to the Republicans real hard, and I expect that the earmarks are just going to get bigger and better than ever.
I hope not, because for the reason I just said, I kind of think that they might not. But you're right. If the White House wants to do it and they are able to pull it along by having veto-proof majorities, that gives the Democrats more opportunity to do that.
Oh, boy. Does that mean we're going to see more bailouts for companies like Bear Stearns? Because, as you know, just a few months ago here over in England, they nationalized the Northern Rock Bank, and Martin had a good rant about that.
I certainly did, because, you know, we spent, I think it's probably going to be in the region of $100 billion on bailing this bank out. And I know there are going to be people listening to this show that we haven't spent the money and it's all sort of earmarked money. But it's fundamental that, isn't it strange how a government can find the funding or find the way to bail out a bank, a private enterprise, for $100 billion. And it is interesting that Bear Stearns wasn't potentially bailed out by the Federal Reserve directly, but I think they gave a substantial loan to JP Morgan to help facilitate that, whereas in the UK, none of the banks were prepared to work with the Bank of England to do that.
Well, we've had a lot of experience with bailouts in America. I remember 20 or 30 years ago, we bailed out New York City, which got itself too far into debt to pay. We bailed out Chrysler Corporation once or twice, cause of the theory being that it was too large to let it fall, that it had too many ramifications for the suppliers and so on. Bailed out Continental Illinois Bank, which wanted to get into the credit market business and even sent credit cards out to dog. We bailed out Pennsylvania Railroads with Amtrak. So we've got a lot of experience with that. We may have helped England, you know, with Rolls-Royce and Lockheed on that 1011, the 1011 jet. Rolls-Royce went bankrupt, and that caused Lockheed to go bankrupt. But as you know, Lockheed Marietta is still a big producer of the C-130, so they managed to get through. And I don't know who owns Rolls-Royce now, but they're still making engines.
They certainly are.
Who does own Rolls-Royce?
Well, there's a difference between the Rolls-Royce cars and the Rolls-Royce engine company. I believe it's BMW, I think, own the name to the Rolls-Royce cars. But Audi, I think, own the rights to produce the cars. Long, long story. I'm sure someone will correct me on that one. I'm not sure who actually owns the aero engine business. So maybe someone can post into the show thread later on and educate us all. But one of the things that was interesting, Justin was saying that, you know, potentially the Democrats are going to win it, maybe he or she. And I'm just curious what you think about this. And I'm looking at a member thread by Biggie Smalls, who says Democrats must win superdelegates to gain the nominations. And I'm hoping I'm just going to paraphrase a little bit what he says, that, you know, potentially Hillary Clinton may be looking to the superdelegates, Don, to ensure that she gets the nomination. So I'm just interested, you know, as you're a staunch Democrat, how you see this and whether you think that the superdelegates should actually have a say in deciding who is the Democratic candidate.
Yes, thank you, Martin. I do have an opinion, and the opinion is this. The superdelegates were the people who already hold office. All the members of Congress are superdelegates. All the governors, of course, Democratic members, all the Democratic governors, past presidents and so on. There's about, altogether, there are 700, actually, there's 800 superdelegates. The 10 of them that represent Democrats abroad, there are 10 that are Democrats abroad superdelegates, but they're only given a half vote. So you look around and you'll see 795 votes for of the superdelegates, but in reality, there are 800 people. 800 people get to cast 795 votes. But getting back to your question, so they were there. They've been there since the Walter Mondale campaign because the Democrats wanted to be sure as best they could that popularity alone didn't get you in the short run of the primaries, didn't put a person like Senator McCarthy, the good McCarthy, into the presidential nomination where they thought a more mature person should have been. So it's a way for the long-time people, the people who've been around a long time, to have a chance to say what they want to say. And, of course, we are talking political parties, and we do want to win. And so, therefore, I think it's I think 20% of the delegates are superdelegates. I feel like that they have a proper role in the nominating process, and I think they will do the right thing.
But how do you think the Democratic Party, and I'm going to throw an example to you, let's say, for example, that Barack Obama clearly gets a majority of the party nominations, Hillary Clinton is maybe 18% behind and gets the nomination because of the superdelegates. How do you think the American people may see that one, in that someone who potentially had the popular vote within the Democrat primaries and caucuses isn't actually the candidate?
They would take that very badly. I think that would be a bad move. The trouble we see now, the Democrats, we can see that this has happened. We didn't expect the Republicans to finish so far ahead of us. But here, you know, the last primary is June the 3rd. This is only March. April and May, we got to go two more months. We're chopping up on each other. And so if no matter which one of them wins, the other side is likely to be very unhappy. The Tennessee governor, Bredenson, a Democrat, has proposed that as soon as like June the 4th, he wants the superdelegates to announce their preference so that we can actually have like outcome of the convention will be known on June the 4th so that we don't continue going to the conventions August the 24th. Then we'd have all of June, all of July, most of August to keep on making chopped liver out of ourselves. And so I think Governor Bredenson of Tennessee has got a good proposal, and I definitely hope that that they do that. He even went so far as to suggest that they ought to have a meeting, a convention of all the, they wouldn't want to call it a convention, of course. They should have a meeting of all the superdelegates, let Obama and Clinton make a presentation, and then let them express their preferences. We're still going to go to Denver on August 24th. But let them let their preferences be known so that we can have a nominee like John McCain as the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. We could have the same, and then they could go toe-to-toe from June 4th onward.
How much do you think with the superdelegates that Bill Clinton has an impact there?
I think that not much. I think up at the beginning of the race, I think everybody underrated Obama. I don't think anybody gave Obama his just dues. And that was not necessarily anyone's fault, because he had only been a senator in the state of Illinois, a state senator, and he'd only been 2 years on the national scene. And so there was no reason for people to realize the potential that he had. And so I think everyone felt like that Hillary Clinton, with her time in the White House, whether or not she got shot at in Bosnia, I do not know. She's already said she didn't. But in any event, she's had experience, and she's been around government longer than most of us have. And so I think that she was a likely candidate, and she was the best qualified woman. And I felt like a woman was due. It was time for a woman, and she was the best one.
We couldn't get Hillary Clinton on the show because her people simply weren't satisfied with our security arrangement.
I guess there'd have to be at least a 30-second delay between our answer and whether or not in the question.
And, John, I've got a couple of more questions that I just wanted to throw past you. I noticed there being a couple of threads, and I'm looking at a member thread from Before Time. Who will be Obama Hillary's vice president? And he's got some ideas on here, so I'll chuck them at you, and then you can disagree with them or maybe fire some back to us. He's got, for Barack Obama, he's got Condoleezza Rice, Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, probably a fairly obvious choice. And then we move around to Hillary Clinton, and he's got Bill Clinton. Ah, that's an interesting choice. Barack Obama, and then he's also suggested this member Before Time that the final one might be Senator Chris Dodd. So chuck us your views on that, Don.
On the first one there, with Barack Obama, I think he's talking about Condoleezza Rice. She's a lightweight. She's a lightweight. She's all right. She's a lightweight, though. Then he mentioned
Ted Kennedy.
Oh,
Ted Kennedy.
Well, Ted Kennedy's like me. He's like John McCain. Ted Kennedy's too old.
We know he can swim.
Huh?
That's appalling. God.
I love Ted Kennedy. He's, after all, he's the primo liberal in the Congress. So I love Ted Kennedy. But he's too old. That doesn't change that.
And then naturally, Before Time said Hillary Clinton, which I suppose you'd have to have an obvious choice. And then he went through to Hillary's suggested ideas, and he suggested Bill Clinton, and I've got to say that could actually be a fun ticket.
Well, who's the poster on this one?
Before Time.
Yeah, I hate to make Before Time feel badly, but the Constitution prohibits Bill Clinton from running for vice president. It says in there that no one can be vice president who's not eligible for president, so that's not going to happen. So
that's a bit of education. That's a bit of education, Don, which I wasn't aware of, so I've got to thank you for that one. I thought anybody could stand for the vice president's job. Thank you very much.
Anybody but a guy that's ineligible for the presidency. Everybody else is eligible.
Okay.
The White House interns breathe a sigh of relief.
And then I think I think the other one you chuckled at was Senator Chris Dodd.
I didn't mean to chuckle at Chris Dodd, because I like Chris Dodd, but he shares the same problem that Joe Biden, Ted Kennedy, and Don White have. We're too old. Can you imagine working 20 hours a day, 30 days a month? Because these guys do that. I don't necessarily agree with their output. It seems like a shame they work so hard and get so little. But they're working nevertheless.
I don't know. I like the paycheck that goes with those half days.
That I could use, too.
Well, hey, Don, I'd like to thank you for being on with us today. Would you care to wrap things up with a final statement? Anything that you'd like to say to us, or about your experiences on AboveTopSecret.com?
Okay, well, I like AboveTopSecret.com. I like it a lot. I like AbovePolitics.com. I like that a lot. I like you, Justin, and I like you, Martin, and I like this interview, and it's been a pleasure for me to be here. I only want to say that I'm looking forward to November the 4th. I think that unless we have a vast improvement in the war, that would change the whole outcome of the election. But I don't foresee it, unfortunately. I do not foresee it, unfortunately. I have to look forward to that with some gloom. But otherwise, I do think that this will be a Democratic year.
I'll put a prediction in the time capsule for us. How many percentage points does John McCain lose by?
I see a close race. I see 53-47.
All right, we'll lock that one in, and thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, and thank you for your time.
Our pleasure, Donnie. Great to have you on the show. Great interview. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin.
Well, I have to say, a fun-filled, controversial interview. I've got to say, we hit the mark with Don today, don't you think?
Oh, we're going to have him back. I think we just scratched the surface there. It's nice to meet an ATS member who's not afraid to talk, and if you get a chance to go to abovepolitics.com, you're going to find that Don has no trouble talking, that's for sure.
Nope, he certainly does, and this is also an invitation to anybody else. If you'd like to come on the show and have your 30 minutes of fame, go to the show thread, put it in, or you to you, either Justin or myself. We're always interested.
Now, we should, real quick, like here, take care of last week's trivia challenge.
Absolutely. Had me stumped until I saw the answer. Someone posted the answer.
Yes, indeed. Okay, my question was, what nifty thing was on President Reagan's desk? And that, of course, was answered by Expert 11, who is our resident know-it-all for the time being. And that was jelly beans. And by the way, Martin, Mrs. Thatcher was a big fan of the jelly beans. She liked the jelly beans a lot. And as a matter of fact, on her way out of the United States after visiting President Reagan, she asked to have some sent back to jolly old England just for her.
Because we don't get good jelly beans in this country. We get good jelly babies, but not good jelly beans. So I can actually see there's some common sense there in that one. Anyway,
Hit us with more common sense. What's your trivia challenge?
Common sense must rule me out. Anyway, I've decided to try and push the boat out a little bit harder and see if I can stump some people for a while. So mine is a two-parter. And guess what? You need to deliver both parts to this show thread to get the 500 handmade applause points. So my question is, the first part, how many countries signed the original NATO agreement in 1949? And then the part two is, one of them kept something back later. What was it? So, a two-parter. Hopefully it might take the guys and girls out there, a little bit longer to get the answer.
That's going to be a tough one. You're going to get some hate mail for that, you know.
Hey, I don't mind. All mail is good mail. When I look at the U2U stack, I see good stuff. I don't mind seeing some bad stuff because it means that people are fired up enough to either talk to you or you to you me. I welcome it.
Outstanding. Well, hey, before we totally wrap up things today, we've agreed to give Dave Rabbit a little time at the microphone. He has some thoughts he'd like to share with us. So as we come to the end of another glorious Above Politics show, we'll go out on the words of Dave Rabbit. So thanks again for your time. I'm Justin Case.
And I'm Martin Bain, and we'll see you next time on the Above Politics show.
This is Dave Rabbit. And the following opinions and thoughts are mine alone and do not reflect any position of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. At the end of the Vietnam War, there were over 58,226 GIs who were killed in battle and never returned to their wives, girlfriends, sisters, brothers, mothers, fathers, or friends. There were over 1,800 GIs who were termed missing in action or prisoner of war. Every day the war in Iraq rages on with more senseless deaths of both civilian and military personnel. I want you to close your eyes. I want you to picture in your mind the soldier at Valley Forge as he holds his musket in his bloody hands. He stands barefoot in the snow, starved from lack of food, wounded from months of battle, and emotionally scarred from the eternity away from his family, surrounded by nothing but death and carnage of war. He stands, though, with fire in his eyes and victory on his breath. But he looks at us now in anger and disgust, and he tells us this. I gave you a birthright of freedom born in the Constitution, and now your children graduate too illiterate to read it. I fought in the snow barefoot to give you the freedom to vote, and yet you stay at home because it rains or you've had a bad day. I left my family destitute to give you the freedom of speech, and you remain silent on critical issues because it might be bad for business or because there is no profit in courage and honesty. I orphaned my children to give you a government to serve you, and it has consistently stolen democracy and freedom of speech from the very people it is supposed to serve and be accountable to. It's the soldier, not the reporter, who gives you the freedom of the press. It's the soldier, not the poet, who gives you the freedom of speech. It's the soldier, not the campus organizer, who allows you to demonstrate. It's the soldier who salutes the flag, serves the flag, and whose coffin is draped with the flag that allows the protesters to burn that same flag. When you go to bed tonight, I want you to remember all the soldiers around the world in your thoughts or prayers, who stand up day after day for their country and say that nothing is going to happen to you on their watch. Wish for them to be protected from harm as they protect each of us. Try to help their families when you can for the tremendous sacrifices and selfless acts that each of them perform for all of us in our time of need. Remember, you don't have to support any war to support the troops who are fighting and dying in it. This is Dave Rabbit, and that's how I feel. Peace.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.